Murphy could tell that this was not the first time they had worked together. They were like a well-oiled machine. Abrams nodded, and Jacob slowly turned the knob and opened the door. They entered a small hallway that had two doors opposite each other. One door was open, the other closed. A flickering blue light came from the open door along with the sound of the television. They inched down the hallway toward the open door. Abrams looked at Jacob and signaled for him to keep an eye on the closed door. Jacob nodded. Murphy was a couple of feet behind them. Abrams rounded the corner of the door with his gun ready for action, then paused and surveyed the room. He looked back at Jacob and raised one finger. Jacob nodded. One man was lying on a couch in front of the TV. He had fallen asleep. Abrams crossed to the couch quickly, put his hand over the man's mouth, and whispered in Arabic, "Don't move." But the startled man did move. As he started to struggle, Abrams hit him with the gun. "That will slow him down a little." He searched the man for a weapon and found a .32 automatic and a very impressive knife. Abrams recognized it. The special knife had sharp blades on both the top and the bottom. This man must have been a trained assassin. Abrams nodded to Jacob to go to the closed door. Jacob turned the knob as quietly as possible. The door handle clicked. Anyone in the room might have heard the sound. He waited for a moment and then slowly opened the door. He had the door partly open when there was a yell in Arabic and the sound of a gunshot. Murphy couldn't see the bullet, but he saw Jacob twisted and yelling. Jacob fell back against the wall in the hallway and collapsed, the gun falling from his hand, blood flowing from his thigh. Abrams had ducked down and away from the doorway. The Arab was yelling as he came out of the room. Seeing Jacob on the floor, he swung his gun toward him to finish the job. Then Murphy sprang forward, shouting. The Arab tried to swing the gun in Murphy's direction, but it was too late. Murphy blocked the gun arm with his left hand. His right came forward with a twisting karate fist into the Arab's left temple. The man fell to the floor, unconscious. Murphy kept moving past the door opening. The sudden silence was shocking. Abrams and Murphy were listening for any sound that might reveal the presence of another terrorist. Jacob was gritting his teeth, trying not to make a sound. Abrams was the first to speak.
"Michael, are you all right?"
"I'm fine, but they've shot Jacob."
"I'll be okay," Jacob replied grimly. "Check and see if there is anyone else here."
Abrams and Murphy searched the apartment but found no one else. As they came back to the hallway, Jacob spoke.
"They're all alone. The others are probably nearby at some bar. These Muslims are not like the rest. They like their alcohol and women."
Murphy helped Jacob into the living room. Jacob looked at the man who was on the couch.
"Ah, no wonder he fought you. That one is Ibrahim, the uptight zealot. You hit him pretty hard."
Abrams and Murphy stopped the bleeding in Jacob's leg, then searched the apartment. Near the telephone was a clean pad of paper. Abrams picked it up and held it at different angles, studying it in the lamplight.
"Someone wrote on this and removed the note."
He grabbed a pencil and began to lightly brush it back and forth over the pad. Soon, fine white lines emerged from the depressions created on the pad by the last note written. It only contained one word.
"Presidio," Abrams read.
"Presidio? There's a military base called Presidio in San Francisco. It's next to the Golden Gate Bridge," Jacob said.
Murphy spoke up.
"There is also a sleepy little town called Presidio in Texas. It's on the border between Texas and Mexico. The Rio Grande runs between Presidio on the American side and Ojinaga on the Mexican side. Presidio has grown to about 6,000 or 7,000 people due to the amnesty program for undocumented aliens. During the Mexican Revolution, General Pancho Villa used Ojinaga as his headquarters for operations. It would be a perfect place to infiltrate the border."
Murphy had barely gotten the words out of his mouth when the man on the couch regained consciousness and leaped onto Abrams' back, trying to choke him. Instinctively, Abrams made a fist with his right hand. At the same moment, his left hand came on top of the fist. He twisted slightly and drove his elbow into Ibrahim's stomach. The pain and loss of air made the man bend forward. As his head went down, Abrams turned around and brought his knee up into the terrorist's face, sending him backward against the wall to collapse on the floor, his nose broken and bleeding. Jacob was crawling toward his automatic, which Murphy had picked up and placed on a table. Abrams was reaching for the gun in his shoulder holster. Ibrahim, dripping blood, looked like a trapped animal, desperate to escape. His eyes darted back and forth from Abrams to Murphy, then to Jacob on the floor. Abrams spoke in Arabic.
"Tell us about Presidio,"
Ibrahim screamed back.
"Never, you infidel devils!"
Then he turned and started to run. Abrams and Murphy both leaped forward, but he was just beyond their reach. He threw himself through the window, yelling,
"Allah be praised!"
Ibrahim landed on the fire escape just outside the window. Now he was bleeding from several cuts caused by broken glass, in addition to his broken nose. He scrambled up the stairs toward the roof.
"Michael, make sure Jacob is all right. I'm going after this one,"
Abrams called over his shoulder. Murphy grabbed the gun off the table and propped Jacob up against the couch.
"Here," he said, "you take the gun in case anyone comes back. I'm going to help Levy."
Chapter 24. The sudden roar of the lion startled Daniel out of his thoughts. Two were snarling and fighting with each other. He could hear the clatter of teeth and the slapping of paws against fur. The lion relaxing next to him bolted up with a snort as the two males tumbled toward them. Daniel tried to move but was not quick enough. His joints had grown stiff and sore from the den's cold rock floor. He was an elderly man. Swiftness of movement was a thing of the past. The two fighting lions rolled right over him, knocking the wind out of him. He couldn't believe how heavy they were.
"How ironic to be crushed to death in a lion's den," Daniel thought.
But it was just a brief skirmish. Daniel quickly checked his body for bleeding wounds. He didn't want the lions to smell fresh blood. The fight had come on too quickly for Daniel to pray. He had been too shocked to react. But he now found himself thanking God that he had not been injured by the wild beasts.
"My friends would be surprised to see me alive," he thought. "I can't believe this is happening to me."
The strange evening dragged on with Daniel slipping in and out of sleep. He had a hard time separating the reality of the den with the reality of over 60 years of memories of being a Babylonian slave in the king's court. He could hear King Nebuchadnezzar's words as if it had been yesterday.
"Well, Daniel, no doubt I do not need to explain why you are here."
"You have been troubled by a dream, my king. An awesome dream that stirred your spirit. And yet when you awoke, not a fragment, not a shred of it remained. Only an empty echo, like the sound of a word in a strange tongue."
Daniel remembered how this troubled the king.
"You saw a great image, O king. The head of the statue was of gold, wondrously bright like molten fire, the chest and arms of shining silver like the moon when she is full. The belly and thighs of the statue were of bronze, the legs of iron, the feet of clay and iron mixed."
Even though Daniel foretold of the destruction of Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, he remembered how the king had rewarded him by making him the chief administrator over all of the wise men of Babylon. He thought back to how Nebuchadnezzar's heart had become hardened over the years. He would not acknowledge Jehovah, the God of heaven. His pride was too great to give God credit for establishing his kingdom. In his arrogance, the king erected a 90-cubit-high golden statue in his honor. He acted like he had superhuman power, until that fateful night, the night God struck him with insanity.
"Master! Master! Wake up!"
Daniel could feel his assistant shaking him.
"What is it? What time is it?"
"Master, the royal guards are at the door. You must come quickly. Something has happened to the king."
Dressing hurriedly, Daniel joined the guards who had chariots waiting. They rode like the wind to the palace.
What could be wrong with Nebuchadnezzar? He was a very healthy man. Had he been attacked?
As they drove into the palace courtyard, Daniel could see soldiers rushing downstairs with the king's servants following them. Everyone was yelling and screaming. Daniel rushed over to the captain of the guard, who was shouting orders.
"Tarub, what is happening? Where is the king?"
"He's gone mad. One moment he was eating dinner, and the next moment he was tossing food and plates. He growls like a wild animal. We tried to restrain him, but he is extremely powerful. He seems to have the strength of 10 men. We locked him in his chambers and called for the astrologers and wise men. A few moments ago he escaped and ran into the fields across the Euphrates. The men are looking for him now. Can you do anything?"
Daniel turned and looked through the gate and out toward the fields. He could see many torches in the distance. A guard ran up to the captain as Daniel was offering a silent prayer for wisdom.
"Sir, some of the men have just found the king. He is near the canal that waters the fig trees. Over there, to the left, where the torches are gathering."
As he got out of the chariot, Daniel could see the king on the ground, circled by soldiers who were keeping a good distance from him. They didn't want to provoke him to run again. Nebuchadnezzar was down on his hands and knees, digging in the dirt. The soldiers parted ranks to let Daniel through. He was well known as a great man, a man who had the wisdom of the gods. All eyes were on him. As he moved closer to the king, he could see what Nebuchadnezzar was doing. He was digging up plants and eating the roots. His eyes were wild. Saliva mixed with dirt was dripping from his mouth. He growled as Daniel grew nearer. Daniel stopped and squatted down so he would seem less threatening. He began to talk in a very calm and soothing voice.
"O King Nebuchadnezzar, what troubles you? I, your servant Daniel, am here to comfort you. May I have permission to speak?"
Growling loudly, the king threw the plant he was uprooting at Daniel, who fell over backward. Daniel knew the king wouldn't get well until God allowed it to happen. Yet Daniel remained faithful to the king. Every week for 7 years, he'd go out to the fields to visit and try to talk to Nebuchadnezzar. Sometimes he would find field workers throwing rocks at the king, whose hair and nails had grown long. They'd yell and call him names. Daniel would chase them away. He felt sorry for Nebuchadnezzar, a king who lived like an animal. God humbled Nebuchadnezzar for 7 years as he groveled in the dirt in the shadow of his palace. His wits had been scattered to the four corners of the wind. During that period, his great kingdom was almost destroyed. It hung together by a thin thread. His jealous neighbors were plotting its overthrow until God brought back his sanity.
"Oh God, please keep me humble. Please keep pride from overpowering me. Don't let me forget that you and you alone are the one who puts people up and can take them down, just as you did Nebuchadnezzar," Daniel prayed.
Chapter 25. As Abrams climbed through the broken window, he looked up. He could barely see Ibrahim climbing the fire escape stairs about a floor above. Abrams yelled for the man to stop, even though he knew it was useless. Their shoes made a lot of noise against the steel of the fire escape. Above that sound, Abrams could hear Ibrahim shouting death threats in Arabic. There were 8 stories to the old tenement, and by the time Abrams reached the roof, he was breathing heavily. He paused for a second before sticking his head up to see. As he peeked up, he heard the sound of a gunshot and felt the spray of brick next to his face. Instinctively, he ducked down.
"He must have had a gun hidden on the roof somewhere."
Abrams took out his gun, raised his arm above the wall, and fired 3 times in the direction of the gunshot. Then he could hear Ibrahim running on the gravel of the roof. As he popped his head over the wall again, he could see the Arab disappearing around the elevator shaft. He fired and saw a brick explode close to Ibrahim's shoulder. Abrams leaped onto the roof and ran toward the small building. By the time he had reached it, Ibrahim was nowhere to be seen. Abrams poked his head around the building, staring into the darkness. Just then, the zealot fired. Abrams fired off several rounds, and then there was silence.
Murphy was just starting up the fire escape when he heard the first shot. Maybe there were more Arabs. He began to climb as fast as he could, as gunshots echoed through the night. A battle was taking place, and he had no idea who was winning. By the time Murphy reached the roof, there was silence. As he peered over the wall, he couldn't see anyone, just a small building. Carefully, he made his way over the wall toward the building. He had almost reached it when he heard two muffled shots in the distance, not from the roof. Had they come from the apartment? Murphy reached the small building and peered around it. Levy Abrams was standing upright, his hands raised. The zealot Ibrahim was yelling at him,
"You are going to die, you Jewish pig!"
Murphy shouted. Ibrahim turned at the sound and fired. Both Murphy and Abrams hit the ground. Ibrahim then turned back toward where Abrams had been standing and pulled the trigger, but the gun was empty. Abrams leaped up and rushed forward. His right hand hit the inside wrist of the Arab's gun hand, just as his left hand hit the back of the gun hand. The gun went flying. Ibrahim ducked down as Abrams' body weight came forward. He, too, had been trained to fight. The zealot then rose and flipped Abrams onto his back. The wind was knocked out of him. By now, Murphy was running toward the battle. Ibrahim heard him coming and ran, with Murphy trailing after him. Once he'd regained his breath, Abrams too pursued the terrorist. It only took a few moments for Ibrahim to reach the edge of the building. He leaped onto the outer wall, then hesitated. The adjacent building was about 10 feet away. His only chance for escape was to leap. Murphy yelled,
"Don't do it! You'll never make it!"
Ibrahim briefly crouched down and sprang. His hands were up, and his entire body was extended as he crossed the gap, crying,
"Allah be praised!"
Abrams had just reached the edge in time to see the zealot's hands grasping bricks on the top of the other building. Then the rest of his body hit the wall. The impact jerked his hands free, and he began to fall. Murphy and Abrams watched helplessly as Ibrahim dropped 8 stories, desperately flailing his arms and legs. His body hit the alley below with a sickening thud. Abrams and Murphy looked at each other. There was a split second of silence, and then the same thought seemed to hit both of them at the same time. Jacob. They ran across the roof and back down the fire escape. As they clambered through the window, they could see Jacob on the floor with his eyes closed and the gun in his hand. At the sound, Jacob opened his eyes and pointed the gun at them.
"You're alive!" Abrams exclaimed.
"Yes. After you left, I could hear the gun battle. Then I heard some noise in the hallway. The other Arab must have woken up. I could hear him, but couldn't see him. All of a sudden, he dashed to the front door. I fired twice, but I don't think I hit him."
"We have to get you out of here into the safe house," Abrams said,
reaching down and lifting his partner. Murphy grabbed his other arm, and the three limped to the elevator. They could hear noise behind other doors. Some of the other tenants were probably calling the police. But they also knew that no one would leave their apartment to see what was happening, not in this neighborhood. There was too much danger of being shot yourself.
"I'm sorry to get you mixed up in all of this, Michael. You don't need this kind of trouble," Abrams said ruefully.
"I'm just glad I was here to help. When I know terrorists are planning to do something to the country I love, how can I just stand around and do nothing?"
"Michael, after you drop us off at the safe house, get back to your hotel. Act as if nothing happened. We must get information back to our group. I'll try to contact you later. Thanks again for your help, especially on the roof."
"What happened up there?" Murphy asked.
"I guess I got sloppy. During the gun battle, Ibrahim yelled and hit the ground like he had been shot. I ran over, thinking he'd been wounded. He was just faking and got the drop on me. If you hadn't yelled when you did, I wouldn't be walking out of here now."
Abrams, wearing gloves, went through the dead zealot's pockets, searching for clues. Murphy, holding the flashlight, looked at the body and asked, "What's that on his neck?" Abrams moved the collar of his shirt slightly.
"A crescent moon with a star. You see it on the flags of many Muslim countries.
Murphy got closer and shined the light directly on the tattoo. No, this is different. Look closely, Levy. In all Muslim symbols, the points of the crescent moon point to the right or up with a five-pointed star or several stars. This crescent moon is pointing down to a star with six points made up of two triangles, similar to the Star of David. And look at the points of the crescent. Three small lines are coming off each point.
Yes, I see them. They almost look like claws that are closing in on the Star of David.
Those aren't claws like a cat's. They look more like the talons of a bird. Abrams looked up at Murphy.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Murphy glared at Abrams.
Do you think Talon has Arab terrorists working for him now? How does Presidio tie into all of this?
I don't know, Michael, but I do know I'm going to Texas for sure.
Chapter 26. Murphy had a difficult time going to sleep that night. Adrenaline was still coursing through his system. His mind kept reverting to the evening's events. He could see Matthew sitting up in the car, staring into space, with a slight trace of blood dripping from his lips. He could hear Jacob yell as the bullet tore through his leg. He remembered Ibrahim leaping onto Levy's back, attempting to choke him to death. He could feel his fist strike the Arab in the temple. Man, that really hurt, he thought, grimacing as he flexed his knuckles. He then flashed to Isis's face and her words to be careful. If she only knew how close he had come to death. He thought back to his emotions as he saw Ibrahim attempting to leap through space, only to fall to his death. And the crescent moon with the talons. Finally, he drifted into a restless sleep, thinking about one word, Presidio. The sound of the phone ringing startled Murphy. It took him a moment to remember where he was. He groped for the receiver, muttered, "Hello," and heard the automated voice announcing his 7 a.m. wake-up call. Great. He slammed down the receiver. Then reality hit him. Breakfast with Isis at 8. Murphy had decided that it would be best not to tell Isis what had happened last evening with Abrams just yet. He would wait for a more appropriate time. They had a lot to do today, and he didn't want her to worry. After breakfast, they headed for the Federated Bank and Trust to retrieve the contents of Dr. Anderson's safe deposit box. In the bank, Murphy spoke with the manager, explained the situation, and handed him the notarized letter with the power of attorney.
"Oh, yes," the manager said. "I've already received a copy of the letter. I also had a phone call with a Mr. Lenny Harris from the Quiet River Nursing Home who explained everything. We were expecting you."
The manager took the key from Murphy, retrieved Dr. Anderson's box, and left Murphy and Isis alone in the safe deposit customer room. Murphy looked at the key the old man had directed him to take as he lay dying. Could the contents of the box be worth Dr. Anderson's life? Murphy looked at Isis. He could tell that she was excited. She loved new adventures. Slowly, he opened the large safe deposit box. It was filled with file folders and a journal. He read the titles aloud as he removed the files from the box one by one. The first folder is titled Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, The Theosophical Society, Annie Besant, Lucifer Magazine, Zygana Averna, now that's a mouthful, Alfred Meinrod, I've heard of him, he's a scientist, Carmine Anguisse, Kalinda Anguisse, J.M. Talpish, The Friends of the New World Order, The New Age, and a handwritten journal. It almost looks like a daily log of some kind.
I wonder what this is all about.
I'm not sure. All I know is that when I spoke with Dr. Anderson, he mentioned the end of the world and a one-world leader. This may provide clues to what he was talking about.
Michael, there's a library right across the street. Let's go over there where we can spread out and read through these folders. If we both read, it will speed up the process a little.
Great idea. Murphy put the folders and the journal into his briefcase, and they left the bank. As they crossed the street,
Isis looked at the old four-story library. It had six tall Roman pillars in front and a set of marble stairs. The soot of many years had turned the white marble a dull gray. Pigeons milled around, cooing on the roof and the steps. Carved into the marble above the pillars was this motto: "Through wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established." Proverbs 24:3. A chill went down her spine as Isis looked at the library. Something was wrong. She couldn't put her finger on it. Was it the building itself? Was it something inside the building? Something in the material they were going to examine? Or was it something else? She couldn't shake off her unease. She almost felt that someone was watching them. But when she looked around, she didn't catch anyone looking in their direction. Everything seemed normal, except her feelings. "That's silly," she told herself. "Don't mess up the excitement of Michael's find with women's intuition." As they entered the old building, they came into a great hall filled with tables, rows of oak book card catalogs, racks filled with books, and an old information desk. Behind the desk was a dowdy, chubby woman in a white dress with large blue polka dots. Isis looked up and could see each floor of the library circling the center hall. Anyone standing above could look down on those in the center of the open hall. Behind the railings above, Isis could see stacks and stacks of bookshelves with people milling about. If it had not been for her uneasy feelings, Isis would have enjoyed the library. It made you want to come in and spend the day soaking up great thoughts. If only she could shake off the eerie sensation and relax in the friendly environment of books. Murphy and Isis climbed the marble stairs and went to the back of the library on the third floor. There they found a secluded table where they could lay out the material and begin to read. The thousands of books that surrounded them seemed to soak up sound. They could talk softly here without bothering anyone. It was almost like they were in their own little world. It was even a little romantic, just the two of them. "I just wish I didn't have this chilling feeling," Isis thought. "Maybe I should say something to Michael." Chapter 27. Stephanie Kovacs called Shane Barrington from her cell phone. His secretary told her that Barrington was in a meeting and would be back about 4 p.m. "Good," Kovacs thought. "That will give me about 2 hours before he'll be back home." She drove quickly to Barrington Towers, parked in the lower garage, and took the elevator to the top floor. Although she had her own apartment, she'd been spending most of her time with Barrington at his penthouse. She remembered back to when she first moved in and how excited and how much in love she'd been. "What a fool I was," she told herself. It was a pleasant arrangement for the first few months, but then the trouble had started. She remembered the night when Barrington spoke those chilling words. "Promise me you won't do anything foolish so I'd be forced to dispose of you. I've grown very fond of you, Stephanie. I'd hate our relationship to end in tragedy." That night, fear entered her mind and began to grow like a weed. She knew then that she hadn't really loved Shane Barrington, but had fallen in love with his power and money. As an investigative reporter, she had the ability to sniff out corruption and shady business transactions. Barrington Communications was beginning to stink. After those first few months, she had begun to ask too many questions about his business dealings, and he didn't like it. It was then that the yelling had begun, punctuated with Barrington hitting the walls or doors with his fist. It took all her negotiating skills to calm him down. Eventually, her fear grew to the point where she was afraid to question anything or to discuss any sensitive subject. Her fear had created distrust, and her lack of security had begun to grow into resentment. She knew that she had to get out of the relationship. This was her opportunity. She could pack all of her things and move back to her apartment. At least they wouldn't be sharing the same bed anymore. She couldn't pretend that everything was okay when inside she was in emotional turmoil. She could no longer sleep with someone she had lost respect for. No amount of money or power could soothe that pain.
Kovacs had closed her last suitcase when she heard what sounded like a key in the door. She panicked, stuffing her bags into the closet and closing the door. Then she ran into the bathroom, where she nervously pretended to put on lipstick.
"Maybe he'll think I came home early."
"Stephanie?"
Barrington's voice sounded from the living room.
"I'm in here."
She hoped her voice sounded calmer than she felt. In the mirror, she could see him entering the bedroom.
"I got through early with my meeting and decided not to go back to the office," he said, smiling. "I saw your car in the garage. What are you doing here?"
"I got through a little early myself."
Barrington slid his arms around her waist and looked at her in the mirror. She tried to smile like she was glad to see him, but she was actually repulsed by his touch. He turned her around and kissed her. After he walked away, she trembled in fear.
"How about a steak dinner tonight? I'm hungry," he said.
With that, he turned and headed for the closet.
"Where would you like to go?" she asked, hoping to distract him.
He hesitated before reaching for the door handle.
"I don't care. You pick."
He was still looking at Stephanie when he opened the door to the closet and stepped in. He stubbed his toe on her first suitcase and almost fell over the other two.
"What the?"
He paused, trying to process the scene. Then he stepped back and looked at Stephanie, the color draining from her face.
"Is this what I think it is?"
"Shane, I was going to talk to you about this."
"Talk to me? When? After you had run away?"
Stephanie could see his face darkening in anger.
"I trusted you," he shouted. "I thought you were loyal. You know how I hate disloyalty."
"Shane, you know we've been having more and more fights. I just think it would be best if we separated for a little while to let things cool down."
Kovacs was beginning to back toward the living room as Barrington advanced.
"So you're just going to run out," he shouted. "No one runs out on me."
He clenched his fist. The veins in his neck were standing out. Stephanie started to turn to run, but Barrington caught her with his left hand and whirled her around toward him. At the same time, he slapped her, sending her flying across the living room. She tripped on the coffee table, breaking the vase, and rolled off the corner of the sofa onto the floor. It took a few seconds for her head to clear. There was a ringing in her left ear, and the whole side of her face was stinging, and she could feel an instant headache. Barrington was furious. He snatched her up and shook her.
"No one runs out on Shane Barrington!"
With that, he slapped her again, sending her into a lamp that fell over, shattering a large wall mirror. This time, Stephanie could hardly move. She was dazed. She could taste the salty taste of blood, feel the pain inside her mouth where the skin was ripped. As she sat up, her head spun. Blood was dripping from her nose onto her white blouse. She was in too much shock to cry.
"Oh, God, please help me."
Barrington had disappeared into the bedroom, but soon emerged with her suitcases. He threw them at her. The first one bounced on the floor and then into her chest, knocking out what breath she had left. The second one bounced off the first case and into her face. Her head flew back, hitting the wall, and then there was blackness. When Stephanie awoke, she was cold and disoriented. It took her a moment to realize that she was in her BMW in the lower garage of Barrington Towers. Her whole body ached. Slowly, she sat up and looked around. The garage was empty except for a few cars. The pain in her face was excruciating. She flipped on the dome light and looked into the rearview mirror. She didn't recognize what she saw. There was blood all over her clothes and in her matted hair. The left side of her face was dark, puffy, and swollen. Her eye was already turning black. She looked like she had just been run over. She ran her tongue across her teeth. One was chipped. She could see her suitcases in the back seat. Barrington must have put them and her in the car. After several deep breaths, she found her purse and fumbled around for the keys. She could only see out of one eye.
"I thought he was going to kill me. I can't believe I'm still alive."
As she put the keys in the ignition and started the car, she noticed something on her windshield. She tried to read it, but it was written on the outside and was backward. She tried to focus with her right eye. It was written with lipstick. Finally, she could make it out. It read,
"No one runs out on me."
Stephanie was glad that it was 4 a.m. and everyone was in bed when she finally got home. She didn't want to run into anyone looking the way she did. She left the suitcases in the car and went straight to the bathroom. She turned on the water for a tub bath, took some aspirin, and crawled in. The warmth felt soothing and healing. As she finally was able to relax, she began to sob. After 45 minutes, the hot water finally ran out. She gathered what energy she had left and dragged herself to bed. The emotional and physical drain had been enormous. She was asleep in a few minutes. It was 3 p.m. when Stephanie's home phone rang.
"Stephanie, it's Melissa. Are you all right?"
Barrington's secretary was whispering.
"I'm not feeling good today. I'm going to take a sick day."
"Stephanie, are you sure you're all right?"
"Why are you whispering, Melissa?"
"I'm away from my desk at another phone."
"Why?"
"I'm afraid. I've never seen Mr. Barrington so mad. He ordered me to clear out your desk and put all of your belongings into boxes. When I asked him why, he yelled at me and said, 'If you want to keep your job, do as I tell you.' He's never acted this way before. I overheard him call Lowell Adrian, the human resources director, and tell him that you're fired immediately. Then I heard him say, 'She'll never work for any news organization if I have my way. She's through for good.'"
Kovacs's spirits dropped even lower. Not only had she lost her own self-respect by becoming a mistress, she had broken a power relationship and gotten beaten up as a result. Now, she was being blackballed from working for any news media. All possible sources of income were drying up. Trying to hold back her tears, she said,
"Melissa, I appreciate your calling, but you have to get off the phone. If Shane knows that you've called me, you'll lose your job. I can't bear that guilt. Go and don't call me again. It's too dangerous."
Stephanie began to weep. Her life was falling apart. She was swimming in guilt, fear, frustration, and anger. Emotions surged over her like giant tidal waves. Her life was a mess, and there was nothing she could do about it. She curled up in a ball and cried for an hour. Then the tears were gone, and depression began to take hold. She was filled with despair. It was late in the evening, as Stephanie was curled up in bed, that the first ray of hope poked its head through her dark cloud of depression. A word came into her mind. Happiness. She remembered Dr. Murphy asking if she was happy. She thought back to the time she interviewed him after the loss of his wife. He certainly wasn't happy then, but he did seem to have a peace about him. He said that only God can give peace in the midst of turmoil.
"I'm certainly in turmoil, but I don't have any peace.
I wonder if there is anything to all this God talk."
Her mind began to drift back to Dr. Murphy's comments about a kite.
"Stephanie, when the kite was out of sight, how could you tell if it was still there?" "I guess by the pull of the string. It meant the wind was still blowing the kite." "Right. That's sort of how it is when God speaks to you. You can't see him, he is out of sight, and you can't audibly hear his voice because he is too far away, but you can feel his loving tug on the strings of your heart. Do you feel the tug of God on the strings of your heart today?"
Gentle tears began to flow from her eyes.
"Dear God," she prayed, "I'm hurting and lonely. I think you are tugging on me, trying to get my attention, and you've got it. I don't know what to do. I need your help. I've really made some poor choices, and they've affected my entire life. It's a mess. If you're up there somewhere listening to me, I need your help. I know I am a sinner, and I need you to change my life. I can't do it myself. I've tried more than once. I believe you sent your son, Jesus, to die for all my wrongdoing. Please forgive me. I'm not sure what all this means, but I feel you knocking at the door of my heart, and I want to open it to you today. Please come in and help me to have peace."
With that, Stephanie cried herself to sleep. Chapter 28. Murphy opened to the first page of the journal, which read, The Journal of Harley B. Anderson. Isis began reading Helena Petrovna Blavatsky's file. Using a colored marking pen, occasionally Murphy highlighted something. The only sound was the turning of pages. After about 45 minutes, Murphy spoke.
Isis, listen to this. I've highlighted certain dates and comments in the journal. They give an overview of what it contains.
April 17, 1967. Today, J.M. and I were contacted by three men from a group called the Friends of the New World Order. They want us to artificially inseminate a girl for them. May 22, the group from the Friends of the New World Order again met with J.M. and me and informed us that they have selected the girl to be inseminated. June 12, we again met with the Friends of the New World Order. They promised to pay for a fully equipped lab. That will cost a great deal. They told us that after the birth of the baby, we could keep the lab and all the equipment for our own use. They said that they had one stipulation, that we would have to keep the entire matter in absolute secrecy. They are very strange. July 3, J.M. and I met the young woman to be inseminated for the first time. She seemed nice, but a little frightened. Her name is Kalinda Anguis. She is Romanian, and J.M. had to translate and explain the procedure to her. July 10, today we received the sperm and eggs provided by the Friends of the New World Order. They would not tell us who the donors were. Strange. July 13, J.M. and I completed the procedure of implanting the fertilized egg into Kalinda Anguis. July 20, we examined Kalinda Anguis and everything seems to be going smoothly with no complications. August 10, today J.M. and I met with members from the Friends of the New World Order. They again stressed absolute secrecy about Miss Anguis and the entire procedure. They seem to be very nervous and quite demanding. J.M. and I are very curious. September 4, J.M. and I met for lunch. He shared his concerns about what we were doing and about all of the secrecy. He has fears that we may be doing something illegal. We both do not care for the people we have met. They seem evil. September 29, I was able to find out details about the father and mother of Kalinda Anguis. The father is Carmine Anguis, and the mother's maiden name is Kala Matrinka. October 14, I received a phone call today from the Friends of the New World Order. They were extremely demanding and firm about the secrecy of what we are doing. I am beginning to agree with J.M. We may be doing something illegal. October 17, I did some investigating and was able to discover who the egg donor was, Karis Mazikeen. November 30, I was able to trace down the mother of Karis Mazikeen. She is a lady named Mariana Yakov. She told me her mother's name was Zigana Averna. I am beginning to feel nervous and uncomfortable. J.M. thinks he is being followed. December 28, the holiday season was uneventful. January 15, 1968, I have made an amazing discovery. The sperm donor is the famous scientist Alfred Meinrad. It is a very curious situation. February 7, I was able to uncover information about the great-grandmother, Zigana Averna. She worked for a woman named Alice Bailey. February 20, a group from the Friends of the New World Order visited our clinic and talked with Kalinda Anguis. J.M. and I were not allowed to be in on the conversation. She seemed very agitated after they left. March 14, J.M. has found out information about the Friends of the New World Order. He told me that he was very frightened. He told me he would talk about it when he was sure that we would be alone. March 31, Kalinda began contractions around 8 p.m. April 1, the boy is born. The mother and child are doing fine. Members of the Friends of the New World Order came to the hospital. They were very adamant that the boy get the best care possible. They were almost rude to us. April 29, J.M. has apprehensions about the arrangements with the group. He says that we must talk soon. He sounds very frightened. May 12, terrible tragedy. J.M. was killed in an automobile accident. The police said that he was traveling at high speed and could not negotiate a turn in the mountains and drove off a cliff. I am very frightened. J.M. did not like to go to the mountains. He never sped anywhere, always driving under the speed limit. I feel like I must protect myself. I don't think it was an accident. I believe that he was murdered. I have decided to send all of my notes and papers to my daughter in the United States. I have instructed her to put them in a safe deposit box in an unknown location.
That does sound very strange, Michael, Isis said thoughtfully. Who do you think the Friends of the New World Order are?
I'm not sure. In my talk with Dr. Anderson before he was killed, he was convinced that they were evil people who had an evil plan of some kind. He even suggested that he might have helped in the birth of the Antichrist.
You mean the Antichrist of the Bible that you're always talking about?
The same one, Murphy said soberly.
Isis had grown up in a household where the myths and religions of the world had an almost tangible presence. Her father, an archaeologist, had such a deep interest in the deities of the ancient world that he had named Isis after not one, but two goddesses. Her middle name was Proserpina. Like her parents, however, Isis grew up without any kind of Christian belief. But Murphy was different from most Christians she had met. There was something about him that was genuine and intellectual and attractive. The Ararat adventure had shaken all of her ideas about the Bible and religion. She had actually walked on Noah's Ark. There was no doubt about that at all. She had also helped him find Moses' brass serpent and Nebuchadnezzar's golden statue. They were real, and she could touch them. She was beginning to believe that Murphy's faith was real, and the Bible was real, and it frightened her. At some point, she would have to make a decision as to whether there is a God or not.
I need to be open-minded. What if there is a real Antichrist?
The thought made her shudder. Chapter 29
Michael, listen to this. I've been reading some of these other folders.
Murphy looked up.
This Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky is very interesting,
Isis began.
She was born in 1831 and died in 1891. In 1875, she founded the Theosophical Society. Its logo is an alchemical symbol of a circle formed by a snake eating its tail. Inside the snake circle is a symbol of two interlocking pyramids representing the union of heaven and earth. In the center of the pyramids is an Egyptian ankh. At the top of the pyramid is a circle with an inverted swastika inside of it. As you know, the swastika is a well-known occult symbol, believed to have originated in ancient India. The words surrounding the snake say, "There is no religion higher than truth." It says that she wrote a book entitled The Secret Doctrine.
"I've heard of that book," Murphy said, excited. "Adolf Hitler kept a well-marked copy of it beside his bed. He was a follower of Madame Blavatsky. That must have been where he got the idea of using a swastika for his military uniforms."
"Dr. Anderson lists that she also wrote another book, Manual for Revolution."
"Wow, that's something. I've heard of that book, too. It was one that Sirhan Sirhan requested while he was in prison for killing Robert Kennedy. This Blavatsky woman had some interesting followers. I've heard it said that she's viewed as one of the greatest occultists in history. She founded Blavatsky Lodge and the Esoteric School."
"It looks like Dr. Anderson did some research on her," Isis said thoughtfully. "He lists that as a child, Blavatsky was restless, impetuous, daring, reckless, and had a fearful temper. He goes on to say that she had a passionate curiosity about the unknown and an unusual interest in the mysterious, weird, and fantastical. She used to scare her playmates by telling them that there were subterranean corridors under their home that were protected by hunchbacks. It is said that she could cause her playmates to hallucinate. She even claimed to see a Hindu in a white turban. He was her phantom protector. She said that she received her directions from him telepathically. He became her spirit guide."
"She sounds like Shirley MacLaine," Murphy grinned.
"According to Dr. Anderson, She would go into a trance and become a channeler. She was into table rapping, materializations, seances, and had psychic powers and could move objects at will.
Murphy laughed out loud. She sounds very talented.
Here's an article that says she led a wild life of wandering the world for about 10 years. She was shipwrecked on the island of Spetsa, sailing from Greece to Egypt. At one point, she went abroad disguised as a man and fought under Garibaldi. She was wounded and left for dead in the Battle of Mentana in Russia. And she established the Theosophical Society and wrote those books I mentioned. Dr. Anderson quotes her in one of her writings saying, "Lucifer is divine and terrestrial light. The Holy Ghost and Satan are one and the same."
I think her theology was a little messed up.
Dr. Anderson goes on to say that Madame Blavatsky heavily influenced two women, Annie Besant and Alice Ann Bailey. Besant was an activist in the feminist movement. She was especially involved in birth control. She was generally looked at as a socialist political radical. For 10 years, she and Alice Ann Bailey published a monthly magazine entitled Lucifer.
Murphy made a face. Today, they would probably make the magazine into a television series, or at least a Saturday morning cartoon program.
She was married to Frank Besant at 19. He was a clergyman who had traditional views. Those views clashed with her independent spirit, and she left her husband. In the process, she rejected Christianity and became an atheist and freethinker. She was instrumental in developing the foundation for the New Age movement.
Isis turned a page and continued.
Alice Ann Bailey started a number of organizations, including the Lucis Trust, World Goodwill, Triangles, the Ariane School, and New Group World Servers. She compiled 21 books with over 10,469 pages of material. She claimed that she wrote them while she was in a trance state. They were dictated to her by her spirit guide, Jwal Kul, the Tibetan. It is from her writings that words like reincarnation, astrology, meditation, karma, and nirvana became popularized.
Boy, those spirit guides really are into literature, aren't they?
It says that the Lucis Trust was founded in 1922 under the parent name, Lucifer Publishing Company. Hey, Michael, just listen to some of the famous people who have belonged to the Lucis Trust. Robert McNamara, Ronald Reagan, Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, Paul Volcker, and George Shultz.
Huh. Isis, did you know that these very men were part of the Council on Foreign Relations? It's the elite group that influenced the founding of the United Nations. I remember that the Lucis Trust was headquartered for many years at the United Nations Plaza. I believe they've moved to somewhere on Wall Street now.
What do you think about all this, Michael?
It sounds like Madame Blavatsky became an occultist and influenced Alice Bailey, who took her work and expanded on it. She, in turn, started Lucifer Magazine and other organizations that continued the occult teachings. Her works and organizations then influenced men who started the United Nations. It doesn't make for a pretty picture.
Murphy picked up another folder.
It sounds like those gals were triple threat charmers for sure. What do you think they had to do with Dr. Anderson?
I'm not sure yet. I've got some more reading to do.
Chapter 30. John Bartholomew smiled to himself.
This is the perfect change of pace. No one will even notice us. It's one of the most crowded cities in the world.
He was getting tired of meeting in the castle, and Switzerland was too cold. He wanted to enjoy the sun for a change. Besides, Señor Mendez had made arrangements so everyone could fly into Rio de Janeiro on separate planes. He had rented a large villa beyond Copacabana Beach near Rodrigo de Freitas Lagoon. It was a secluded spot where they would be alone and could bask in the sun.
How appropriate, he thought, to be able to make plans to destroy Christianity, the rule of law, and set the stage for the Antichrist in the shadow of Corcovado Mountain, with the giant Christ the Redeemer statue on top. Señor Mendez has a sense of humor.
The meeting began at 10 a.m. on the shady veranda. Jacoba Werner was the first to speak in her thick German accent.
Her blonde hair was tied back in the usual tight bun.
I would like to commend Señor Mendez for his choice of location. The accommodations and the dinner last night were superb.
I will second that, said Ganesh Shesha. This reminds me of a presidential palace 50 kilometers outside Calcutta. I used to visit it often.
Well, I'm sure that we all appreciate the sun rather than the snow, said Bartholomew. Let me call this meeting to order. You will recall that at our last meeting, you were all given assignments to work on for our sevenfold plan for world governance. I will report on phase one.
Bartholomew passed out a detailed paper outlining the first phase.
Let me highlight phase one, the relocation of the United Nations. We have begun to plant the suggestion into the minds of key UN leaders to consider moving the United Nations organization from the United States to Babylon in Iraq. We believe that this move will do several things. First, it will please the Europeans that America is losing its influence. Many European countries already resent U.S. policies and politics. They will think that the Americans are getting what they deserve for trying to control the world. Everyone likes to see the big dog have its ego deflated. It will help to isolate the United States from the rest of the world. Second, the move to Iraq will please the Arabs and help to unite them. It will give them a sense of prestige. They'll believe that they are rising in power, and they'll think that they have some control over their future. It will also help to settle the various factions that are fighting with each other. Rebuilding Babylon will bring back Arab pride and give them all something to focus their energy on, especially if it becomes the headquarters for the UN.
Viorica Inesco tossed her red hair. In her thick Romanian accent, she asked,
"Wouldn't the Europeans object to having the UN in Babylon rather than somewhere in Europe?"
Bartholomew smiled.
"Some of them may indeed object, but those in leadership positions will not care. They know that the UN is just window dressing anyway, all talk and no action in the final analysis. The UN would collapse instantly if the United States and the European Union withdrew their funding. The key leaders in Europe know that they have the real financial power and the expertise to control the Arab nations. They would strongly support the Arabs in exchange for lower oil prices. The United States would still have to support the UN or be accused of being Arab-phobic. They will cave in to the political pressure. That will cause a drain on U.S. finances and help to weaken the dollar. A crisis will soon occur that will help to expedite this phase."
Bartholomew gestured to Ganesh Shesha, who smiled slightly. His white teeth stood in sharp contrast to his dark skin.
"Phase two involves an increase in the threats of war. We have begun a plan to create a crisis between India and Pakistan. The threat of a nuclear war will help to cause political turmoil in the United States. It will get their leaders bogged down in time-wasting negotiations and political posturing. We will then send funding to key African warlords. They are egomaniacs already, and they will expand their power. They will begin eliminating their enemies, as they did with the extermination of hundreds of thousands in Rwanda and the fighting in Somalia and the Congo. The funding of certain Muslim factions will enable them to turn their anger toward the Christians in their countries. It will be wonderful to see the United States attempt to settle conflicts on many fronts."
The other six nodded in agreement.
"We have already started stirring up the North Koreans over the nuclear issue," Shesha explained. "We will increase the conflict and cause the United States to deploy more Navy ships and Army personnel to the area. At the same time, we will increase the rumors that China is attempting to take over Taiwan. More resources will be drained from the United States. We have already begun to complicate the nuclear threat in Iran. The Americans now have to spend time planning war scenarios for that country. At the right moment, we will instigate a combined attack on American consulates around the world. In conjunction with this, we will fund terrorists who make strikes at major seaports like Long Beach, California, and in New York City.
The Americans already have a difficult time with security in these areas.
Bartholomew looked at Senor Mendez.
I believe that you are next.
Yes. The next phase involves the boycott of U.S. trade. Our plan is to shut